This is Robin Umber, April 27, 2009, and I'll be interviewing Janice Bogstad at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Janice, could you tell me your date and place of birth?
Well, I was actually born in the old Sacred Heart Hospital downtown in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I have 5 siblings, and most of them were born there. And that was February 6, 1950.
Thank you. And what is your race?
Well, I'm European, Scandinavian, white.
Okay.
German and Norwegian.
Okay.
With more Norwegian. And a little bit of Alsatian.
Alsatian is from?
Alsace-Lorraine.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And how many male and female siblings do you have?
I have 5 siblings, 2 sisters and 3 brothers. We came out evenly, although not in that order.
Okay. And what is your birth order in the family?
I am the first daughter, the third child. When I was born, my mother was very excited because she expected to have a girl first or second. And so finally I came third, and she was very pleased. She had been waiting to name me Janice for some time.
And what is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse?
My husband, Philip Caveney, neither of us changed our names, is retired at this point. He was a maintenance supervisor in Madison, a night maintenance crew. But currently he also has an internet book business, and he's a writer.
Okay. And where did you attend school, and what degrees have you earned?
Do you want me to start with grade school?
I went to
Black grade school, and I was the first group from Blacks with the first group from Black school to go to North Junior Senior High. That's what it was when I was in 7th grade. So I went there for 7th and 8th grade, 8th and 9th grade, and 11th and 12th grade. For 10th grade, my parents were guilt tripped into sending me to Regis. So for my equivalent of sophomore high school year, I went to Regis High School. We're a Catholic family, which Catholic Norwegians are rare as hen's teeth, but that's another story. let's see. And then I begged, borrowed, and stole my way into Madison. I had my parents had been intending that I go to Eau Claire, but I have a mitral valve prolapse. And a man came to speak to us about people with disabilities getting money to go to school. And I had clandestinely applied to Madison. My parents told me not to bother because my brothers were down there being, one brother was down there studying to be an engineer, and it was too expensive. And I went to talk to him afterwards. No counselors or anything said anything to me. I was an extremely shy child. I used to run around with my hair, long hair in front of my face, and kind of lumber around. And I talked to him, and he said he thought I qualified. And so they sent me off for tests, and it was just so bizarre because I never thought of myself this way. But then I have lots of very smart and talented siblings, so I never really thought of myself as being unusual in any way, except for I was a science fiction fan, which was odd for a girl, supposedly. But then my sisters were too. Anyway, they gave me a bunch of tests, and they said that it would be a shame for me to go to Eau Claire at that time. So by that, I figured I must have had some kind of IQ or some other marker that they interpreted that way, which sort of reminds me of what happened to my dad in the service. He only got 6 weeks of high school, and they tested him. And he was so smart that they put him in actually it was radio school to start with a bunch of college students. So that was my first indication that I might actually be able to try to do something more than work in a dime store or have 10 kids or, you know, what my mother kept telling me was going to happen to me. She used to say things like, "We know, Janice, you're going to have to change if you're going to be happy because there aren't any other people in the world like you. And, you know, you're just going to be and have no friends forever." So fortunately, my dear sweet mother was wrong. I walked onto the Madison campus 1 year when I was a freshman in high school to go to a debate tournament. And I looked around and I thought, wow, this is where they keep all the people like me. It was very weird, you know, but that's what I thought. Yeah. That was the first thought that came to my mind. And that's when I decided, when I was first year student in high school, that I was going to school in Madison. So I spent the rest of the time trying to figure out how to do it. And, of course, in my day, there weren't any scholarships for women. There were football scholarships and basketball scholarships, and et cetera, but there was no Title IX, so women didn't get them. Not that I could have, anyway. I didn't get coordinated till I was 23 or 24.
So then you went to Madison?
I went to Madison to college. Yes, I'm getting digressing already. And I got a BA and an MA in comparative literature for a BA for French and German in comparative literature for French and German 20th century, an MA for Anglo-American French and Chinese 20th century, and then I did a PhD in comparative literature in 20th century, all those languages and history of Chinese literature. And then I also got a library MA.
Wow.
So, well, you know.
All at Madison.
All at Madison, yeah. Yes, right. Well, I had various jobs, sometimes as many as four. And the odd thing, though, for my interest in women's studies is that because of all the language courses I was taking, comparative literature requires you to read and do work in one modern and one classical language in addition to your own. So I decided I would do two or three, and because it was fun. And not that I'm terribly good, but I really am interested in. In fact, that's why I'm interested in Tolkien, is I'm very interested in all the invented languages and that whole idea of knowledge versus speech. So I wasn't able to take any women's studies courses per se. I took one French seminar, which was concentrated on women and biography. But even at Madison, it was difficult to fit the women's studies courses in with the other stuff, and they weren't even really there till I was a graduate student. So I did get a science fiction course in, though. In fact, a friend and I started the science fiction course with a professor in Madison. Yeah.
Okay, is there anything else about your general background that you think is important?
Well, usually what I say to people, I give a lot of lectures about what science fiction does for women, and usually what I talk about is how science fiction saved my life, because it gave me perspectives on life and the possibilities that you don't get in a small farm community. I grew up in the countryside, that's the other thing I should tell you, on a farm that's now under the new highway at the end of LaSalle Street, and it's in the town of Seymour, and I was always considered to be odd in some way, even among my siblings, because all I ever wanted to do was read. And what science fiction taught me was what you could do with that, and that there were other ways in the world to live and be than what I was told was my intended fate. My mother was a very sweet and hardworking woman, but she really wanted a daughter that she would get married, and she could give her wedding showers and baby showers and would be a companion and that sort of thing, and I failed miserably at those things. I had two siblings, and one of them tried to do that for her, and there are advantages and disadvantages to that, but the other one became a very, very, very much more than I am left-wing person, political-type person, so... You can see the kinds of tensions that were working at work in the 60s, being drawn in so many different directions for women. There were slight bits of possibilities, but people were always telling you they weren't for you. So that's one of the things that I think was important, is I had science fiction as this coda that always said, there are other ways to be, it's okay to be smart. I taught myself how to use a slide rule when I was 12 because my favorite female hero in a Robert Heinlein book knew how. And this was before we had calculators and those sorts of things. So if you're going to do anything scientific, you had to use slide rules. So Then my brother lost my slide rule, but that was another sad story. So we were quite a big, and as I go through life, I realize demonstrably affectionate family. But none of us are alike. We're not, in from the inside anyway. I mean, we span the political spectrum from very, very conservative to very, very radical. My one sister and I don't have children. We decided we didn't. I decided when I was 7 I wasn't going to grow up and get married and have children. There were various reasons for it. My fatal flaw was one of them, my heart problem, which I was aware of when I was 5, because it was talked about as, you know, don't ride your bicycle, don't run, don't walk uphill. You know, I ignored all those things. But it's always, you know, you always have that thing going on in the back of your mind. I decided, in fact, this is another thing that I found has really affected my life. I was told I was going to be dead by the age of 30, or I was going to have open heart surgery and be an invalid. So I decided I was going to do as much as I could in as short a space of time, and I still am affected by that. And it really wasn't until I was 29, really, that I realized that perhaps some of that, I mean, I kind of knew it intellectually, but I didn't know it viscerally, that some of that health information was wrong, and that maybe I wasn't. I've never had open-heart surgery, and I'm obviously not dead. And I'm 59, so, you know, so I figured every year after 30 was, and that's something else, everything after, year after 30 was sort of a gift. And so I wanted to do as much with it as I could. And it's funny how these things that you know intellectually are wrong still, since you grew up with them, they still emotionally affect you. So science fiction and death at 30 were big forces in my life, and I still think about them. Being tall and funny looking was another. So I didn't feel I had to try to conform, because I couldn't. No, my mother used to always collect pictures of tall models, because she thought I had this funny idea. So, but I didn't really want to be a model. It didn't help.
Okay. And so, kind of sticking with your childhood or growing up, could you tell us a little about the community and neighborhood where you grew up?
Well, I grew up on a farm, and we had 97 acres. We had sold 3 of the acres to people to put houses on at the end of the street. And so I didn't really have close neighbors. Probably the closest neighbors we had, one was a family that belonged to a very conservative religion, so they didn't spend much time with us. And the other was Mrs. Fuller, who lived down at the end of the block. And I actually went to communion a year early because I was tall enough to take her to communion. So they wanted me to be able to walk to communion with her. So, you know how they made decisions in those days, this girl is going to do this? Uh-huh. They did that sort of thing. So, and then there were kids at school, and I never had very many friends. I would say at most 1 or 2 at a time. I had one friend in high school who had 3 friends, and so they were kind of all hung out together. So my closest friend until I went to junior high school was my sister, Debbie, who was a year younger. And that separation from Debbie was very traumatic, trying to learn, you know, to be, have a social life outside of the family. And my family did all tends to be kind of, we kind of grew up in that. We had to learn how to be in a social world because we grew up in this kind of little pocket of time space, really, reading our science fiction books and talking to each other and spending the summer together. I mean, one summer my sisters and I spent training ourselves to go into space. And one summer we spent being Native Americans. And one summer we did plays for the neighborhood. And the plays were free, but the popcorn and lemonade was Kool-Aid cost money. We did them in the garage. You know, so it was really a very insular childhood. And the farm is now under the new highway. So we can't even go back and visit it. In fact, to give you some idea of what kind of family I come from, when they tore the farm down a couple of years ago, it didn't bother my father very much. What bothered him is that he had planted a stand of Norway pine, and they ripped those all up, and he couldn't stand to go back there and look at it. He's 93. He'll be 93 this summer. So that's what bothered him, and he came from a family of many children who lived in northern Wisconsin. And he lived in Eau Claire part of the time, Rice Lake part of the time, and a lot of the time he couldn't go to school because he had to help support the family. So he was a bright man, but he's quite bright, but he had to sort of make it all up as he went along.
Okay, so what you were saying, what I wanted to ask was how your family was or was not connected to your community or neighborhood, but now I understand.
Through the church, mostly. The Catholic Church gave us something of a neighborhood, but we weren't really that connected. And my father's family and my mother's family were a lot of our social network. My father had several brothers and sisters, eight, and their families and my mother's side of the family would have these big, like, watermelon feeds or family picnics or whatever, and that was how we socialized. Or my grandpa had my grandfather had lived with us, and he had a cottage on Lake Shaddock, and our social life in the summer was to go up there with all the cousins, sisters and brothers and cousins and spouses on my mother's side of the family, and entertain my grandfather by swimming and playing with the boats. And I used to hide a lot with my books because it was uncomfortable. Cold sometimes to go swimming. Didn't like it that much. But that really was the social network. And then my mother had church groups that she, and my father really didn't have much time because he had a full-time job. He was an electrician and then an electrical supervisor at the tire factory. And at what is now the old Uniroyal plant. When he first worked there, it was called Gillette and then U.S. Rubber. And then he also did the farm with my grandfather. So he didn't really have much time for a social life. They used to go out once a month with people they met from church, basically. So that was really the social network. And then my sister who was a year younger had a lot more friends than I did. And when we were in high school, she was quite popular. I used to think of it as normal sized. And she looked like a girl, I looked like a stick. So sometimes she would have me play with her friends, and most of the time she didn't. Because she was popular and she was a cheerleader. It wasn't until she got to be in her senior year that she got kind of a social consciousness, and then she became a Trotskyist. So, and not only a Trotskyist splinter group, and she now lives in Detroit. So she's even more left-wing than I am. I usually say I'm more left-wing than most people in Eau Claire know what left-wing to be, but she's much more so than I am.
Okay. So who had power and privilege in your community? How did that affect your family?
The priests. And it was pretty clear that up until I was in junior high school, my parents sort of thought I was going to be a nun because I was too funny looking and too odd to get a boyfriend. And I actually really wasn't that interested in boys. I picked a boyfriend when I was a junior in high school because he went to Chippewa and he didn't know that I was odd. And he was odd too. So, in fact, I met him when I was going to a debate clinic here in Eau Claire. The kids from a lot of the neighborhood schools came. And so the priests, and you could tell that they had power over the nuns, so that's what, since I was going to be a nun, that's what I understood. And my father's bosses at his work. And I don't know who my mother considered to be Oh, and my grandfather. He was extremely, he was the patriarch. He was my mother's father, and he was the patriarch. And he lived with us, and pretty much even my father and my mother deferred to him. And my brothers, my older brothers also, especially my oldest brother, who was 8 years older than me. So he's 67 now. So it really was, in the community, it was the priests and, you know, the religious people, and my father's bosses, not like a social group.
Okay. So looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist?
I actually thought of myself as neither male nor female. I remember, first of all, when I was very little, thinking that the things that most girls did absolutely did not interest me. I actually now read romance novels, but I never read girls' books. I read science fiction. And so I anticipated that I would be something, but I didn't know that there was a model for what I was. I thought of myself as the way girls thought of themselves is sort of like Gertrude Stein. I figured this out later, that you were kind of a third something, because most of the things that girls did made no sense to me at all. And yet I was not a boy. I mean, that was fairly clear, right down to the girls did the dishes and boys took care of the farm animals type of thing. So I thought that I might be able to find some kind of niche where it didn't matter that I was smart and female. But I never expected there to be the whole movement. And it wasn't until I was in my first year of college and my best friend who went to St. Olaf College in Minneapolis. See, I still also didn't have many friends in college. She kind of started me getting interested in feminism, which was called women's liberation at the time. And that's when I started learning about these other women who were thirds like me. And some of them actually didn't look like thirds, so that was fascinating. And then for a while I thought that I always thought that I wasn't going to be able to do something because it was too interesting and I would get to do interesting things. So then for a while I thought you had to be a lesbian, and I knew what a lesbian was from reading science fiction, of course. And then I thought, so I thought I couldn't be a feminist because I wasn't a lesbian. And then I realized that it was actually a while later that I realized that there were all these opportunities that kind of thinking allowed me. It allowed me to think of myself as a person who could sort of invent what they were going to do. So I knew I was, from the time I started reading science fiction when I was 5, that I wasn't really a girl. But I didn't know what that meant to me. I knew that it didn't fit, the definition didn't fit. So I guess you could say I kind of knew, but I didn't know that there were so many other people who were trying to do these things. And I sort of figured that I could never have a relationship with a man because I was just too odd. My parents decided early on that if I wasn't going to be a nun, I had to go to college and get some kind of profession because I should be a nurse or a lawyer or something because I would never get married and no one would be around to take care of me. And so, I mean, that was their fear.
Uh-huh.
So we always knew there was something odd about Janice. And in fact, many years later, I worked out that they had thought, in fact, the whole family treated me like I was a little crazy because I cared about things that they didn't think I should care about. For example, my friend and I in high school started something called Turpentines because I was this Dr. Turpin in Vietnam who was trying to get donations to treat people who had been affected by the Vietnam War, Vietnamese and Cambodians and Thais who had been affected by the war. So we started this organization to solicit funds, and he actually came and met with a bunch of people from Eau Claire. My best friend's father helped us to support it. Paula Piper was her name. And her father was a photographer, and he'd been out in the world, so, you know. So there were lots of little markers along the way, and it was only when I got to college that I actually had a chance to realize that there were a lot of things I could do with my life. I think of myself as suffering somewhat from sensory deprivation in high school, because the only thing I had was science fiction, really.
And so I think this is a good follow-up here. Can you describe your occupational path then after college?
Well, I don't know that you would call it after college,
okay,
because I always had jobs. I had my first job when I was as a babysitter for a woman who was a cocktail waitress when I was a junior in high school. And when I went to college, I was lucky enough to get room and board and tuition through vocational rehabilitation. But for anything else, I always had jobs. So my first job was in a medical lab where I cleaned everything. And I'd have my arms full of enzyme test tubes that have little pointy ends in salicylic acid, which is what you clean them with, and the medical students would pinch me. You know, they'd walk by and pinch me. All the medical students were male, you know, and grab me and grope me and things like that. My second job was collating and mailing a farm report. And I really kind of enjoyed that organizational thing. And this is important because I also published, started three journals, and I'm now the managing editor of a journal, partially because I kind of learned something about it from there. And I got so that I would, the professors would come in and watch me sometimes, because I would collate. There was this machine you collated with, and I would study in graduate school my Chinese while I was collating, because I could, you know, set up the mechanics of the machine. Our family tends to be, some people have a talent where they can figure things out with their hands and brain at a non-conscious level, and that's how we tend to learn computers, too. I have brothers who are engineers, and one of my brothers works for a bicycle company. And that actually is part of how I got into librarianship. I started library school three times before I actually went through with it. And so while I was getting doing courses for a master's in Chinese, I started Chinese as a senior in college because I'd learned all the other languages. I was doing that collating job, and then I also worked for a sociology professor coding data on lynching. So then I learned a little bit about theory from that, too. So I ended up never getting an MA in Chinese, but I got my MA in comparative literature. I went back to comparative literature very soon after that. And I was also working as a technical editor for an engineering professor and for health and social services. So I worked as a technical writer and editor and kind of general office organizational help for health and social services, and that's where I learned how to write documents and pieces rather than coming into this. I used to think of writing as this way that you, this thing that you do where you get yourself all hepped up and then it all comes out in a big bunch. And I learned in health and social services when I was between 28 and 31 how to write, how to reorganize information into different formats. I would think of myself as making big documents into little ones and little documents into big ones, because I'd get a set of initiatives and I'd have to go out and interview people and write policy from it. Or I'd get a report and I'd have to do an executive summary. So that really taught me a lot about organizing information and writing. And so all of these things kind of fed in, because I knew it was going to be difficult to get a job teaching Chinese or comparative literature. I wasn't Chinese, and I wasn't, at that time it was very difficult for women to get jobs as professors. It was only very slowly that we managed, and I had one woman professor who stuck with me through my doctorate. She's passed away now. Her name was Fanny Lemoyne. But she wasn't really quite like me. Her father had been a general, and she came from a, you know, higher social class. In fact, she used to talk to me about that, about social classes. And she used to say that we were trying to educate too many people in the 60s. And she didn't occur to her that she was talking about me. You know? So the technical writing and editing taught me about writing and organization. And then as I was going through graduate school to get my doctorate, after I got my master's in 75, I got a bachelor's in 72, a master's in 75, which I actually didn't get. I didn't get it in 75. I didn't get it till 79 because I had some incompletes to finish, and they didn't tell me about that. I could talk to you a lot about the politics of academia. I was an in-state student that fought my way in instead of being picked by some professor, so I got a lot of people ignoring me, basically. I just kind of had to make my own way. And the other significant part of all this, which might not at first be apparent, is that during this time in the 70s, I was also starting the only feminist science fiction convention in the country, and it's still the only one, and a feminist science fiction journal that was nominated for the highest award you can get 3 years in a row. We never got it because we were girls, basically. In fact, they tried to leave us off the ballot 1 year because they didn't think we were really a fanzine, which we weren't really. And then I started that journal called Janus, and then I started another journal called New Moon, which was, I left Janus to the science fiction group in Madison because I wanted to get more theoretical. And we started the science fiction convention, and we thought of it as being, we actually thought of it theoretically as being somewhere between a science fiction fan convention where people dress up in silly clothes and talk casually about fiction and their favorite authors and such, and an academic conference where the papers you presented had to be much more worked out. We thought of it as a works in progress conference. And it's actually been talked about it that way by people who are running theoretical, much more theoretical conferences and organizations and such. At this point in time, WISCON, it's called, is the only feminist science fiction convention in the country. I'm not that much involved with it anymore because I get paid to do this stuff now. But people give formal conference papers there now. And those papers get published. And so you can go there to do more formal things, which is how I envisioned it in the first place, which is, you know, so I'm really, it was first managed through the extension in Madison, and then it became the organization started to make enough money so it could be run by the organization. So that was also involved because I learned a lot about organizational behavior and about managing people and about myself, about what kind of a manager I could be. So I took all of this into a library job. I started working in libraries, first as just a student after I was organized out of my Community Services, Department of Community Services in Madison. I worked for them as that technical editor. And I got a job working in libraries first as a student, but I ended up actually being an LTE within the second semester because one of their people quit. And then I got hired for a job where I was called a floater. And what I did was I went to any of 12 libraries, well, 17 libraries really, on the Madison campus, or seven departments in Memorial Library. On an on-call basis. So you had to be trained in all these areas, and then you went. And I just loved it. I would work in different... I mean, I worked in special collections. I worked in the information desk. I managed the reserve services in the undergraduate library, and I would keep getting part-time jobs there. So that's really, in the 80s, is when my library stuff took out. And I was finishing my doctorate, and at a certain point, I thought, you know, why don't I get a library degree? I'm here in Madison anyway. And I could probably make 2 to 3 times as much working as a librarian than I was making now, and I could still pursue my writing. So all of this time I was also writing. I started the fanzine because people told me, because people told me I didn't know how to write. And this gave me another venue to write. And so all of this time I was also writing book reviews for the Science Fiction Research Association, which somebody introduced me to in the 70s. And I now manage their journal. I'm managing editor for their journal. and the SFRA review. And I was also writing articles. I had several collection development articles published before I was even in library school. And then I met a lot of library people working in libraries, and I thought, you know, these people are a lot more like me than I am like most of the other professors I deal with. Because the professors in Madison, they all have their little areas and they to protect themselves. You know, they protect their territories and they pick the people to, you know, so I had to work out all these politics of not being somebody's favorite and all that stuff. And before I had a feminist group who were studying all these things, I mean, I started reading theory on my own just to try to sort out my life. And the Gertrude Stein course, the course I took on biographies, I wrote on Gertrude Stein. And that was one of the places I started getting into the theory of identity formation, really, and what your social network has to do with your identity formation. But all this time, I'd also been working in science fiction and writing collection development articles about building science fiction collections, and this fanzine, and running this conference, and working for Help and Study. So all these things. So I decided in 1986 that I would get a library degree, too. And they gave me credit for some of my other graduate work. So I actually finished a library degree in a year and a half. And it was actually, for me, the easiest degree I'd ever gotten, because I had all the learning skills already. I mean, I did my bibliographic assignments on Chinese literature, you know, and you did an assignment on banned books. I did that on a Chinese novel called Jinping Mei that has been banned in practically every country in the world. The only place you could get a full copy of Jinping Mei was in Hong Kong, and you can't do that now because it was supposedly too salacious. Too salacious for the mainland Chinese communists, and too salacious for them. And that's another story, which I'd love to tell you sometime. But so all of those forces, I think, really, with a lot of people, it wasn't just my school. It was my work and my avocation, this work with science fiction, and women in science fiction. When we started interviewing women in the 70s, nobody was talking to them. And so we had this big opening. Some of the people who have gone on to be quite famous, we knew, because we had talked to them before anyone else was interested, and we published their interviews, and we talked to them about their careers and all that stuff. So, for example, Octavia Butler was a friend of mine. I don't know if you know who she is. Well, most people didn't hear of her.
I've heard of her name. I have to think why I've heard of her name.
Yes, she's was for a long time the only black woman science fiction writer.
Okay.
And she was mentored by a lot of people, too, in the science fiction community. But outside of it, she was getting some of the same, we talked about this, she was getting some of the same kinds of, well, black women can't be writers types of things that I was getting about farm girls.
Mm-hmm.
It also helped that we were sort of a size, you know. And so I had her invited to one of the early WISCONs as the guest, and people had not really heard of her yet. But I had read these three novels of hers that were published by at that time, the worst publisher of science fiction for author contracts, Doubleday. And I had gotten those books because I knew all the private booksellers in Madison, because I was also involved in the book business, which I still am. So, you know, it's not just one thing. It's all these things that I thought of myself as putting together all these different pieces, and I still do that. One of the things I still do I have these various communities. A man once threatened to destroy my career over some silly thing. He was a kind of an unpleasant guy involved in something called the International Association for the Fantastic and the Arts. And I just sat back and I thought, yeah, which one? The feminist, the librarian, the academic, the science fiction, you know, or the medievalist, or the children's literature, which one, you know? Because that's always the way I thought. I always thought, and it's, my father used to criticize me for this. You should do one thing really well, he'd say. And I always have all these things going, you know. And it's because they cross-fertilize for me. I interrelate. I think of it as data or content or whatever all coming in, and they affect each other. They affect how I organize and think. And so I'm always pulling together lots of different forces. So last year I wrote articles on 16th century for a reference book on 16th century poetry, on women in science fiction, on a medieval historian, Maitland, who I'm very fond of, and on pilgrimages, on pilgrimage sites and pilgrimage routes. And I mean, there's this whole string of, you know, I'm doing a sort of a slightly different set of that right now. I'm editing a book on the Tolkien films, for example. And so I think of it. Yeah, there was a book by Mary Bateson, I think her name is Mary Bateson, called Composing Life. And that's kind of been one of my guides, where you don't have to do one thing and please one constituency. Now, that of course that also leads right into librarianship, because to be a collection development person, you really have to try to understand, to the best of your ability, to understand the needs of people in many different disciplines. So I worked very hard to have an intellectual life so that I could understand the intellectual life. So I publish, and I go to conferences, and I do things about medievalism and science fiction and children's literature as an academic. And I also teach in English sometimes, and I've been on 17 MA committees and directed two for English. I teach in women's studies, and I always teach like history, sociology, and literature. I always pull those things together, often through the lens of language. What is the importance of language? And so for me, there isn't a barrier between my work life, my intellectual life, my social life. These are all for me interconnected. The last thing in the world I would want to do is take a cruise and lay around. What I would like to do is, if I'm going to take a cruise, I'd like to take a cruise to Alaska, where you have sociologists and anthropologists and whatever talking and advising you about how you could learn about various things.
Okay. And so while I've been listening to you, it seems like you also, as you're talking, you're pulling together a lot of the kind of topics
that
you had set down as the question. So one was, you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist, and I feel like you've talked to me a lot about some events that kind of have led to your way of
thinking. And groups I've worked with,
Is there something like specific you'd like to respond to?
There were actually pivotal points in my life. One of the things I had to work out is this concept that I was a damaged person. People used to stare at me because I was so tall and skinny. And I thought they saw my fatal flaw, which I thought of my heart murmur as my mitral valve prolapse. And it took me a long time to work out that that's why I always thought of myself as not having the right to do things. I felt, for example, guilty about taking money to go to college because I thought it should go to more valuable people. Or taking jobs away from people who were more important or whatever. I had to teach myself that the many of the women who were my friends, that they were important people, because I grew up with the idea that you weren't going to be able to do anything as a woman, and so the important people were men. I had to teach myself, and so that's one of the things. I was really 29, and that was a pivotal point in my life when I pulled together all of the reasons why I thought of myself as not worthy, and taught myself that it was okay to have this physical disability because everybody has something like that. It was okay to be funny looking because I wasn't really that funny looking. There were many people who looked many ways. And part of what pulled it together was Gertrude Stein, frankly. I worked on this paper on Gertrude Stein when I was 27 and a little bit into 28. And even after I finished the paper, I kept reworking my ideas about having a female physical body and being a person. And that's how I would codify it. And you know, I'm way past that concept of the theory, but I was 29 in 1979, you know, and there was still a lot of things. People were still talking about women's livers and burning bras and things like that. So 29 was a big year for me. I figured a lot of this out. And another way I think of it is I stopped hating myself for not being something else. And I started really to see what I was. And I often would look back and I think, how did that poor girl make it through all these things I was doing, starting these groups and starting these journals and going through graduate school and being told I wasn't good enough and all this stuff. How did I make it through? And the other pivotal thing was I met a man who taught me that there were many ways to be beautiful and that they didn't all have to be this, you know, conventional thing. And he stuck with me. He stuck with me through many years like that. I wouldn't get married. I thought, I don't believe in marriage. I still don't kind of believe in it. Because it's so easy for a woman to get subsumed in her marriage partner. And he taught me that men didn't have to be like that. And that I could be a sexual being. And so that was another pivotal thing. I met him actually in the 70s. One of the things he told me at one point was that I should stop hating myself for not being as smart as the top 1%, because I was probably only the top 2 or 3, and most people would be happy to be the top 5. Well, I still don't think I'm the top 2 or 3, but that was just like I still tell my female students that, because it was like women keep having to be made more perfect. You know, we're not allowed to do anything unless we're perfect at it. And I actually had college professors who told me that as a woman I would have to be twice as good as men or three times as good in order to pursue the profession, because otherwise I wouldn't get anywhere. They actually said that.
Wow, and you hear people say that, but I didn't.
Oh, they actually said it. I was no one's favorite, and I wasn't. They didn't want to get in my pants. Some of them did, but I pretty much didn't understand that. My husband actually, my current husband, when we actually didn't get married until 1986, but we've been together since 74, or we have lived together since 75. My husband actually explained to me what guys did when they were hitting on you, because I didn't understand it. It never occurred to me that's what they were doing. It never occurred to me I was at all attractive, you know. And so he kind of taught me. He taught me about men and power too, about how to deal with power differently than I had thought of it. I was thought of it as I would never have any. But he sort of taught me how to use the power that I had. And you are who you are. You can organize yourself to take advantage of the opportunities around you, but you can't be somebody else, you know, and you shouldn't really want to be. We can do what have been the greatest challenges you've faced as a feminist. I think for me the greatest challenge was to think that I would be accepted, to think that I had the right to do some of these things and have some of the benefits that accrue from them, that of having a group of women and being able to be proud of women's accomplishments and think of myself as one of those women, because I grew up thinking of myself as not really having the right, and I had to sort of teach myself that everybody has a certain level of rights, and that it was almost, in fact, I think of it sort of as my duty to take advantage of any talents that I have and to work with other people, not just women, but people who have some of these problems. Like, my husband's dyslexic, and we've worked a lot on overcoming people's perceptions of him being stupid, and him feeling that he has, he can explore his talents in various ways. Computers have been a big help with that. And so that was one of my biggest challenges, was just feeling like there were other people who would recognize and value what I could do. And I think if I've made any difference at all, the difference that I've made is in working with young people and helping them to understand that they're not alone, and that some of the forces that they think of as personal failures are not personal failures. And actually, if I dare say the M word, Marxism helped me with that. Some I don't think of myself as a Marxist or specifically a socialist following a particular line, but socialism has had a big effect on my thinking because it got me to look at social forces. And one of the biggest differences I think I've made is when I work with young women, I talk to them about how about some of the things that have happened to me and how I thought my way out of them and how they have to do with the social forces that keep women from realizing their potential. And then I've had a big effect on the science fiction community. There is a lot of feminism going on in science fiction now, but when I started there wasn't. So, and other people have taken it and gone in lots of directions with it that I would not have time for. But even starting WISCON, even though I'm not that much involved with it, in fact, I had a real problem with some of the things people were doing there. But an intellectual colleague from Britain actually helped me to see that a lot of the women who go there get something there that the people who are running it aren't responsible for. You know, it's really, it's a time space where they can actually talk to people who don't think they're crazy for being interested in this kind of futurist thinking. Okay. Some of the greatest achievements of feminism in the past 25 years have been that we've gotten women to see the value of organizations that they can create. That even in the face of being told that they're trivial and told that even in due to the fact that you have to fight with women's organizations, both with the women in them and with the world outside, to see how important they are and to the things that they can accomplish, that we have so many more of them now. We were talking recently about the American Association of University Women, which has a somewhat longer history, and how a lot of the things that they did, they don't need to do anymore, because there are associations of women chemists and women engineers and women in various other aspects of the academy and women in professional life, and those weren't around. You didn't have them. You know, League of Women Voters, and even the League of Women Voters, which is from my perspective somewhat conservative, they have a huge effect, because they have not all women who perceive women's issues would call themselves feminists, and in fact many women working in science fiction don't, because they think it alienates men and they care. You know, I don't care. But not caring gives you a certain amount of power. And in fact, to think of one of the other things I think about is how hard it was for me to acknowledge that sexism existed and it wasn't personal. It wasn't personal failure. Yeah. That's a big barrier, I think, for all women. Is because especially in America, you think that it's all up to you, that you can do anything you want, which of course is true and not true. It's true that there are ways you can work within and outside of and to change the system. But it's not true that it's as easy for you to do some things as it is for a lot of men.
Right. Yeah.
We have developed so many mechanisms to learn, so you can learn about the barriers. And once you actually accept that, which was very hard for me to accept, because I was always told I was not like other girls. That's the male way of divide and conquer. If you have a smart girl, tell her she's not really a girl, you know. And to accept that sexism exists is also to accept that you can work to circumvent it. If you don't accept it exists, then you think of every failure in your life as a personal failure. And, you know, nobody's ever good at anything, but men are taught that if you fail, you go on, and women are taught if you fail, it means you're hopeless. That's really, I mean, that's stating it baldly, but women are taught to think of all of their failures as barriers, not as an experience. And that's another thing that I try to teach, is that a failure is also an experience that can help you with your next accomplishment. For example, the science fiction organization I started, at a certain point, one woman, it was more important in her life than it was in mine. And so she drove me out, basically. Well, I finally got over that because I saw that she has nothing else in her life and I have all these other things. So if she really wants to do that, I'll just use it for what it is, and she can be a big name fan. You know, a big name fan and a quarter gets you on a subway. Actually, it's probably a dollar now. But it took a lot of thinking because that was very important to me for a while.
So it seems like we've already also started to address the other question related that the most important challenges you see feminism must overcome in the upcoming decade.
Some of them are from women themselves, yes, because there are a certain sector of women who don't believe feminism did anything. And they believe all their achievements are personal achievements. And there are also a sector of women who think that feminism is done. And those are two big barriers for us, because feminism is nowhere near done. There are so many ways in which the deck is stacked unequally. And the other thing that feminism does is it explodes the way the deck is stacked. And so it's part of the whole ableism, sex, gender, race, and globally the sort of, I mean, we're coming out slowly of that hierarchy of being Western thought that believes, really honestly believes, that certain races are innately superior to others. And feminism explodes that myth too. So it's a different positioning of powers as you're dealing with race, gender, physiological sexuality, or physiological sex, because gender is the social construct that affects men and women. And you know, so so this is both a challenge and a power, that in order for feminism to be done, this whole way of thinking has to be done. This way of thinking that some people are innately superior to others for whatever reason. And, you know, you can only work on little pieces of that, and everybody works on different pieces. So there are, I mean, the other barrier is we have to really embrace the idea of feminism, not feminism. That there are, people are working on different parts of the problem, and it's a much more complex. I love the concept of interlocking systems of oppression, because the church supports the political arena, supports the interpersonal, supports the, and you know, you have to work on all those areas. And fortunately, I have many, many sisters and some brothers who are doing that, so I don't have to do it all.
So here at UW Eau Claire, what ways have you been engaged with the Women's Studies program? When did you start?
I started working with the Women's Studies program as soon as I came here. I worked with the Women's Studies program in River Falls before that. Originally, I found out about the organization, or about the people who were teaching Women's Studies courses and what kind of program we had at that point. And at the time when I started, I thought it had been here a long time. I didn't realize that, you know, I've been working with them almost 20 years, that we'd only had Women's Studies, a program here, for 5 years before that. There weren't any Women's Studies courses, per se. There weren't any numbered courses. I helped to design some of the first numbered courses. And, you know, that had women's studies. And that was important. Sarah Harder saw that. Sarah Harder is one of the reasons I finished my thesis, by the way. I said one day, this is hopeless. Maybe I'm just as stupid as they say I am. And she looked at me and she said, Janice, you do know that's all bullshit, don't you? And it just was like somebody had thrown cold water in my face, and I thought, yeah, you know, all my feminism tells me, all these people telling me I'm stupid, that's what it is. I have my feelings, but mostly what it is sexism. So I finished my thesis in 1992. And it was on Anglo-American and French feminism, feminist science fiction, because the Chinese department told me I didn't know enough Chinese to write about Chinese. But they'd give me a minor if I didn't write about Chinese. So I did that. I'd already been writing about science fiction all over the place. And then I went off and gave papers on Chinese, because I had a doctorate now. But anyway, so I got involved with women's studies right from the time I walked in the door, and then I helped to start some of the women's studies numbered courses and taught 100, and I started a course, designed the course on research methods. And it was originally a way to get women to stop being afraid of computers and to use the power of the internet and understand what it was all about and stuff. And I ended up actually going to the women's conference in China to talk about that and work with some women who were trying to make it more generally, the internet more generally, a tool that women could use in 1995. And so I've been either just on the program committee and teaching courses, or as on an overload basis, usually, when I wasn't teaching for English on an overload basis, and working with the numbered courses and working then as part of the curriculum committee, or of the steering committee, for 6 years, and I'm now on the curriculum committee. So when I was on the steering committee is when we started working through getting a major. And so I was very happy. I was very involved in working on the documents that got us the major, that got us the permission to plan first. And that was a big study that we had to do. And then as Sarah left and we had an interim, Jenny Shattuck, we were working on the major at that point. And then when Susan Terrell came, we were able to move then towards the major that we got just last year, year before last, I think. Yeah. Right. And it was just fascinating the way it's perceived on the campus as one thing. And then, but the women, it's like the women on the campus have been waiting forever for it to happen. So I have been involved since 1990 to some extent.
Okay. And I feel like you've talked about major contributions or contributions that you've made to the program.
A lot of committee work.
And the courses,
talking to people and teaching and designing courses. I've designed and taught courses with Sheila Smith on feminist theory and on history of second wave feminism. And I'm working on a course right now on women and global violence, and it's about women as terrorists as well as women as victims.
Wow.
Women as perpetrators of violence as well as women as victims. I'm working on an article on women in internal and external terrorist organizations for something that's published out of Madison. And I have several books on women terrorists and a video on the one of the peninsular, you know, Thai, Cambodian, Vietnamese terrorist groups. It's fascinating stuff because women tend to get more involved in those political groups, in the internal groups, because they see it as a chance of changing their status, because the international terrorist groups tend to not be interested in improving women's status.
Mm-hmm.
and the internal ones are.
Okay.
So some groundbreaking work being done in that area.
Something I hadn't really thought about. And then sort of beyond that, thinking about major contributions of the Women's Studies program to the campus, as you said, women were waiting kind of for this.
Yes, they're waiting for the major, but there have also been, there are so many social or what would you call them? Co-curricular, maybe. I hate that word. They talk on. That's another story. But there are so many things women are doing now, like the Take Back the Night things have been going on for a while to raise campus awareness. Long before anyone thought of something like a wage center, mm-hmm. for example. And then Women's History Month, all the activities we do, and the Women's Studies Awards. In one sense, you know, they're internal awards, right, for our students. And in fact, I was the person who suggested we should award faculty. We should recognize our faculty, too. And even if it's just a small gift or something,
right.
We should let people know that focus attention on individual women. In fact, I've been involved with the medieval feminist group, too. And that's one thing that we're doing now is paying attention to women who have contributed to medieval feminist studies. I think all you have to do is go to one of the Women's Studies Awards to see how important it is to these young women who have probably never been highlighted for anything in their lives or anything to do with their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible to think, you know, this is just an internal award, but they bring their parents, they bring their grandparents, they bring their boyfriends, you know, and their boyfriends get to see how many different kinds of things women do that they're honored for.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends who was a student of mine tells me that the speech I gave about her at her wedding was still, people are still talking about it, because I talked about how what her contributions were and how important it was, and you know how it led to her future and how delighted I was to have her as a student. And you usually they talk about boys that way, and they talk about girls in terms of pretty and you know. And if they probably the most important thing feminism has done for me is it's to help me to articulate how important feminism is and how important women working for each other is. And it's important to men, too, because we've, as my husband helps me to understand, we've freed them to think about themselves differently.
That's true.
In a lot of ways. He's taught me a lot about hierarchies among men that he's been able to rethink. In fact, we remember the moment when he became a feminist fellow traveler. Because it was over rape and what rape is,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it's a crime of power,
right.
More than anything else. He was reading, I made him read Against Our Will,
mm-hmm.
which is a history book, and he's very interested, he's gotten degrees in history. And at a certain point in that book, he said, well, if she knows about this, clearly about this historical phenomenon, then I can accept everything else she said. And she did. And he started to realize how women can use, what ways in which women can use the intellectual system to circumvent it, to undercut it, to reform it. And and so we've had a lot of dialogues over time. Serious disagreements a lot of time, too. But it's been extremely, extremely helpful for both of us. One of his favorite, he's working on economics right now, one of his favorite economists is a woman who, I'm not going to be able to remember her name. But she wrote an article, she wrote a book about how the policies that were promulgated by the Chicago School, basically based on a lie, and that destroyed the the many of the people in Chile destroyed their lives. The I'm trying to think of the economist's name too. They're now talking about Chile as this great success story that should be, and they try. That's what Bush was trying to do, was impose it on the United States. And basically, what the policy does is get the larger percentage of the population that doesn't own much of the wealth to accept that their failure was inevitable, and to accept all sorts of draconian policies that eviscerate their economic life by just saying it's science. Oh, why can't I think of her name? Ah, well, anyway.
So I'm learning all these different things to look into more, but is there a story that you haven't gotten to tell or talk about at this point that's most important for you to tell as part of the Women's Studies Oral History Project?
You know, I think I've told a lot of my stories, so you know, I can't really think of anything. One of the things that Women's Studies does for many of us, for we faculty and staff, is it is an enormous source of energy and gratification. Because some of the people we work with really still have mindsets that that sap your energy, basically. Nobody should want that, and nobody deserves that. You don't deserve that. Don't ask for that. For example, I guess this, I'll tell this part of the story. I had to convince the administration of this university that librarians who are faculty can get promoted, because it was their idea, and they told me this several years in a row, that librarians aren't eligible to move from assistant to associate professor. And I basically proved to them that we were. And before that point, nobody got promoted. And after that point, it took me 3 times of going in with all of the documentation. And then finally, the person who was in, he wasn't really a dean, I can't remember what they called them at that time, but who was in charge of the library. He was told no by the administration, and I went in and laid out all my documentation with somebody from TOP. Somebody came with me from TOP, a woman I worked with. And he looked at it all, he said, you know, I think you're right. I think I will go up against them. And if he hadn't been willing, but what I had to do, and this is what I've had to do all along, is prove to them in their own language that it's illogical. And that's the other massive, it's the massive illogic of believing that women's brains are somehow inherently less worthy than men's, and that all women are less logical and more emotional. I mean, the illogic of that, I would always think, when you lay it out, if you lay it out using the right language, they have to accept it, because they're humanists.
Right.
And if you accept, I mean, humanism includes a lot of contradictions, and you can exploit those contradictions. So really, the story I would want to tell is that you can actually use their own system for your process of using their own system, you can undercut it. And so now librarians, if they do the things that you're supposed to do, publish and that sort of thing, they can get promoted, right? But before I did it, it never happened. Took 3 years, and some of my colleagues say they won't acknowledge that. What they say is, well, that was a different administration, but it's actually two administrations. I went through two administrations, you know, groups, people in the administrative position. And so then after that watershed, it's just like when women's studies becomes a major. After that point, you're in the system, and so we get women promoted. We get library people promote it.
Right.
Men too, but I mean, it worked for the male librarians too.
Yeah.
If they do what they're supposed to do, you know,
right.
not all faculty even do that. So at the point where I went for a full professor, I had no problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'd done all the publishing
right.
and, you know, done all the, because for me, it's, like I say, all these parts of my life are integrated,
mm-hmm.
so it's maddening at times. But for me, writing is a form of entertainment. It's not always intensely pleasurable, but some aspects of it are.
Yeah.
You know. And theory is, for me, is intensely pleasurable. It's a very, very viscerally enjoyable pursuit. Even when, like, I read a couple of books by Homi Bhabha. I don't know if you've ever read.
No,
I have not a clue as to what he's talking about. But, you know, I'll get it. I'll get to it at some point.
Figuring it
if
out.
I can figure out programming in COBOL, I out Homi Bhabha, you know, or Chinese, classical Chinese. If I can read classical Chinese, I can read Homi Bhabha. I spent 2 years translating that classical Chinese long poem, a prose poem one. Yeah. So there isn't any one answer is the real. And for me, it sometimes I still don't feel like I belong to feminism,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not worthy. But that's just carryover, you know. I mean, I've watched on this campus, I've watched it grow and contribute to the improvement of people's lives. So that students of mine still talk about it long after, that I've kept in touch with, long after they left. I had a student call me out of the blue and asked me if I could help her find some information because she was picked as the person who should start educating her office about gender issues for Social Security. I've had students call me from England to help them look up stuff so they can get a paper published. You know, they just remember it and it affects their lives forever. And that to me is, you know, aside from any sort of like personal accomplishment or development or whatever, that for me is the payoff. You know, you change the world little bits at a time. And then even at home, to see my husband get his writing published, and being dyslexic and being able to overcome it, and even some very weird bad things have happened. Somebody is trying to steal a screenplay of his, for example. Even that is fascinating to see, you know, that he actually can think about it as a property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it comes from an old Irish family. Old Irish families don't become writers.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
Although his father was a writer, actually.
Well, thank you.
Well, sure.
This was so interesting. There's so many other things I now want to learn from you that,
oh, okay.
that I didn't know.
I wish I could remember that name. Naomi Klein. That's the person. We're going to see her in Madison.
The Economist.
Yes, The Economist.
Okay.
Naomi Klein. Yes, we're going to see her in Madison this Friday. It just so happens we have to be down there anyway. And she's going to be speaking for The Progressive. The editor of The Progressive was one of the people who encouraged me to publish my fantasy. Their first editor.
Okay.
Way back when.
Oh, yeah, I just heard about that in PR, too, about The Progressive.
Yeah. Well, the progressive movement you might have heard of. My husband's father was involved in the progressive movement. My husband's father helped design the benefit system that all of us have.
Oh, and I was
state.
Reading about that, too. Yeah,
his name was Edward Caveney. And he was a progressive, and so a lot of the history of his histories don't always deal kindly with the progressives.
Mm-hmm.
But he lost his newspaper job over being a progressive. He was a newspaper reporter in Milwaukee and then Madison. And ended up being secretary for the Public Service Commission and helped design the retirement system and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't know if you have been able to investigate this at all, but we have one of we have a very progressive retirement
system. Oh, yes.
It was one of the things I learned when I first came here. Yeah. So, I mean, there are some other parts about our benefits that are a little arresting, but he helped design that, and it's been used all over the country.
Well, thank you for spending this time talking to us.